You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, join the search for some of Wisconsin's most majestic birds. Find out how you can get involved in the annual crane count. Now, a federal judge in Texas issued a nationwide injunction last week to reverse the FDA's approval of the abortion pill mifepristone. That drug was first approved more than 20 years ago. The U.S. Justice Department is appealing that decision, and Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call has joined a coalition of states challenging the injunction. Hours after the decision, a federal judge in Washington ruled in a separate lawsuit that the FDA can't pull mifepristone from the market in the 17 states involved in that case. Those include Illinois, Michigan, and Minnesota. The use of the drug for abortions in Wisconsin was already illegal under the 1849 abortion ban that came into effect when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade last year. The two conflicting decisions make it unclear who will have access to the abortion medication. The issue is expected to end up in the U.S. Supreme Court. Want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the judge's ruling that would take mifepristone off the market? Do you think people should have access to the pill? Why? Why not? And what questions do you have about the legal decisions and arguments in these cases? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Susan Liebel is a professor of political science and Warren Research Chair at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be here.
We'll spend most of our time on the politics and law, Susan, and you're not a doctor, but can you remind us what mifepristone is and where it fits into the abortion landscape?
Sure. There are two drugs associated with medication abortions. There's misoprostol, and that is also approved by the FDA, and that causes contractions similar to a miscarriage. Mifepristone, which is the drug that's involved in these cases, is a second drug taken in this regimen, and it helps it helps with effects like nausea. So the two pills taken together are the most common form of abortion in the United States today, with a majority of abortions being medication abortions.
And medication abortions in states where they remain legal could still happen with that other drug, even in the absence of mifepristone, even though that isn't necessarily the first choice for providers. Do I have that right?
Correct. It would be a much more uncomfortable procedure with more cramping and more pain for the patient, but it is still possible.
Let's get into this ruling now from a judge in Texas. Can you talk about the argument from the plaintiffs challenging the FDA's approval from over two decades ago?
Sure. I mean, this is a very unusual case mm-hmm. with a very unusual argument and very unusual language. So normally in a case like this, we would see what we call like AP language, the kind of language that's used by newspapers in an attempt to be fairly neutral. And this usually means relying on terms that are used by, for example, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. What we see in this decision is language from the anti-abortion movement, terms like unborn human, use of the word chemical abortion almost 100 times, or abortionist. So it's unusual in that regard. And also it's unusual as to who brought the case. So normally you need standing to bring a case, which means that, you know, if I don't like a law, I can't just object to it. I have to have some sort of concrete injury. What's unusual about this case is there are no patients who are claiming to have been harmed. It is instead a group of people, a coalition of anti-abortion groups and doctors who are suing the FDA. And they're claiming that the FDA 20 years ago did not adequately review the scientific evidence or follow the protocols when it approved mifepristone in 2000. This is the first time that a court has ever suspended approval of an FDA-approved medication. And if the order goes into effect, it would in fact affect a large number of people.
In theory, a case like this could be filed in any federal court in the entire country. It was filed in this particular court in Texas, guaranteeing it was going to this particular judge. And people have been making a lot out of that. Can you talk about that part of the story?
Yeah, it's called judge shopping, and it's very common. It's done on both sides. You want to look for a jurisdiction that will be as friendly to your side as possible. So that's why we see the 17 attorneys generals going to the District of Columbia, the Eastern District in Washington State, and we see the coalition of pro-life people going to Texas. Matthew Kaczarek is the only judge in that district covering Amarillo. So he was the perfect shop because rather than it being a rotating number of judges, they knew that it would be only him. They knew that he had very publicly opposed abortion, and they could be pretty certain to have as friendly an audience as possible. So that's why they went there. I don't think we should ever talk about who appointed a judge. I think once judges are federal judges, they are judges. However, both sides do look for friendlier rulings.
Now, we've got this ruling in Texas, as you mentioned, the other ruling that seems to contradict it, at least in part of the country, coming out of Washington. That ruling from Texas stayed until this Friday. What's happening now?
So the judge has stayed his own order in order to give an appeals court the ability to step in. So when two district courts disagree, as they now do, one from Washington State and one from Texas, and it will go to an appeals court, and that increases the likelihood of this rising to the Supreme Court, where when there is disagreement among federal judges, you look to the Supreme Court to settle it.
What? We can't predict the future. What kind of things could happen on Friday now? An appeals court could weigh in and do what in the short term?
Well, they can stay this. They can overrule it. They could issue an order. I think I'm not sure that I've adequately said just how unusual this case is. It's not about which side, but it is also just about elements of the case, the language and this idea of standing. So one thing that the courts could do is very narrowly say, I'm sorry, these people have no concrete harm, so therefore we dismiss with regard to standing. And that would be a way of de-escalating this. It's also possible that this will be decided by the appeals court and then be given a faster track to the Supreme Court.
Talking to Susan Liebel, professor of political science at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, looking at abortion medications, a court ruling, an unusual one, as she points out of a federal court in Texas that would take one of the two main drugs used in abortions, in medication abortions, off the market. That would go into effect on Friday, but another ruling in Washington state contradicts that, likely to go to some kind of appeals. You can join in with your reactions, your thoughts, your questions about the legal elements here at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Susan, who is appealing this now? Or I guess, what are the various parties getting involved now? The Federal Justice Department, I understand. We've got attorneys general in Democratic attorneys general around the country. Who now is taking this to court? How are they getting involved?
Actually, I haven't read all of that yet. But what we would see would be representatives from both sides making the case to the appeals court. So them looking at these two conflicting orders and making a decision from there.
If this decision stands, goes through the legal process, courts of appeals, the Supreme Court, what would that mean for abortion access to and this particular medication in states around the country? It would just be, I guess, gone?
There is something called enforcement discretion, which allows safe harbor for entities that are technically violating the law, but where enforcement is seen to cause more harm for public health than non-enforcement. So that means that the FDA could announce that it's not going to go after companies that are, you know, technically violating the law by manufacturing and selling mifepristone. As long as they're following what's called the risk evaluation and mitigation strategies, the REMS, and therefore they'd be sort of maintaining the status quo. To be honest, Rob, I would be misleading everybody if I could say what would happen. Sure. I don't think anyone knows what's going to happen. And I think that that is why this case is causing so much consternation.
Sure. One concern that's been raised outside of the abortion issue is, given the unique nature of this, a judge saying the FDA got things wrong in their approval of a medication 2 decades ago, that this could open up challenges to other FDA decisions against any other medication. We've heard this from the Biden administration. What kind of precedent do you think this could lead to?
Oh, it's hard to exaggerate outlandishness of the case, in that it is saying that anyone who objects to a medication that has been gone through rigorous trials by professionals without any harm, in other words, people with no standing to bring a suit, could just say, well, I speak for people who have been harmed. And there's a very interesting argument going on in the case in which it says, like, well, the women and the girls who have been harmed, they're not here, but that's because they're traumatized and they can't speak to their own concerns. And you know, to my ears, that raises issues of equal citizenship in terms of imagining that women can't bring a lawsuit when they are feeling harm. There's something odd going on there. It would open it up for anyone to challenge any medication. And I also want to underline, Rob, that the people bringing this suit, they are involved in challenging other rulings, specifically medications used for trans people. So even just in this case, what we're seeing is it is not just about medication abortion. And I also want to mention that mifepristone, it is used for miscarriages. Mm-hmm. So it also opens up really serious issues for the women who depend upon that medication after having experienced a miscarriage.
We're talking to Susan Liebel, St. Joseph University political science professor, looking at conflicting legal rulings on the abortion medication mifepristone. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the judge's decision on this pill used in abortions? Do you want to see it taken off the market? Why or why not? What questions do you have about what this all means, how it works in the courts? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Susan Liebel, political science professor at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. She's with us today to explore the legal future of the abortion pill mifepristone after a federal judge in Texas issued an injunction against the FDA's approval of the drug from 22 years ago. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this case, the judge's ruling? What do you think the law should say about mifepristone? Who should be able to access it? How should it be used? Do you have questions? Are you confused? If so, understandably, about how all this works in the legal and political system. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi, Susan. If I understood correctly, you are faulting us who are against abortions for lifestyle issues. You're faulting us for figuring fetuses are human. If that's accurate, then what are they if they're not human?
Dennis, thanks for the call. I think referring to our conversation earlier, Susan, issues of fetal personhood heavily debated, and the judge's ruling, I think, kind of went in that direction some. Do you have some thoughts on that, Susan?
Well, first, I just want to make clear that regardless of your position on abortion, it's possible to present bad science or false expertise, and it's also possible to make claims about standing that have never been used in American law. So I just want to make very clear that no matter where you stand, you should want the law to be well done, and you should want to follow the approach that many people who oppose abortion have followed. What's important about this decision is that it doesn't do that. So I just want to make clear, this is not about which side you're on. It's simply about how it is that we normally proceed. When we make a test case, test cases are usually clean. The plaintiffs have been injured. The injury is clear. And we don't have that in that case. So it's damaging to the rule of law when we're sloppy about how we bring a case. It's not the argument that we're making. You can make the argument in a more compelling way. That is not actually being done, in my opinion, in this decision and the opinion of other legal experts.
Thanks, Dennis. We'll go to Sherilyn now in Delavan. Sherilyn, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Sherilyn?
Well, first, the fact that this case was even heard is ridiculous because the plaintiffs have no cause in the case. No one was injured amongst the plaintiffs bringing it. But secondly, I am a scientist, I have sat on FDA advisory committees approving drugs, and I know the rigorous science that these drugs undergo. And it's just unheard of to me that a judge who has no background in science would try to overturn the hundreds of scientists who have weighed in, and now the 20 years of experience that has shown that this drug should be on the market and has its uses and purposes. So I'm just appalled that a judge would try to overturn science.
Sherilyn, thanks a lot for the call. Susan, your thoughts?
Well, I think it's a very, very important point that Sherilyn raises about the protocols. And I want to make clear, if I haven't already, that the FDA did not apply its usual protocols. It went beyond its usual protocols. Even though this happened during the Clinton administration, there were a lot of politics in how the scientists were asked to do even more. There's a wonderful infographic available at the New York Times that links to the over 100 scholarly articles that have been written about mifepristone, and there isn't evidence that it is unsafe. So we have to be very careful. We can believe that the fetus is a person, but we can still have to show evidence for mifepristone to be dangerous to pull it from the market.
Sherilyn, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Susan Liebel, professor of political science at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, looking at this ruling from a federal judge in Texas that would, effective Friday, take this abortion medication, mifepristone, off the market. Appeals in the works, a rival ruling out of the state of Washington. Not entirely clear what's going to happen over the next 2 days. And Susan, between now and Friday, what are you watching for on this?
Well, actually, you know, I'm grown increasingly concerned as a nation that we agree on institutions, protocols, some of what Sherilyn was talking about in terms of how we define things. And I think what I'm looking for is our ability as a people to agree about certain kinds of requirements, things like standing. And I think it will be important to understand how conservative justices think. Sandra Day O'Connor was an extremely conservative justice, and whenever a case came to her, she always said, we should decide this as narrowly as possible, not as widely as possible, because as judges, we are not elected and we should move slowly. And so I think in this case, the standing issues would allow any kind of justice to at least pause and say, there are issues with standing, let's send it back. And I'm sort of hoping to see that even people who disagree on abortion can agree on the rule of law.
On our concept of the judiciary and looking at it as an institution, we just had this Supreme Court race here in Wisconsin that hinged in many ways on the issue of abortion. The perception that one candidate would almost certainly rule one way and the other candidate would rule the opposite way. Do you worry that the perception in the public is that judges are, the cliche is, politicians in robes?
I do worry about it. I'm actually literally up at night worrying about it all the time. But I think that this the issue of judges is tied to, you know, wider trends in American politics. We have minority rule where we have majorities of people who agree on one side, yet we have gerrymandering, for example, and you're familiar with this in Wisconsin, that can produce what seem like majorities. And with the courts have always been a place where majorities went, minorities went when they felt that they weren't being heard. I think what we've seen over the last decades is the politicization of appointments of judges. We've had the Federalist Society, for example, produce lists of approved judges, and we've seen Republican presidents using those lists. And I think that that has led to a sort of a ramping up of the politicization. And I do worry. I'm not sure about the Wisconsin race. It seems like what ended up happening there was, in a sense, a pulling back of the veil. Politics was already part of the race, and instead it just came out into the open. And I suppose, to be frank, looking at this Supreme Court, this is one of the most political courts there has ever been, and it was produced during strange political manipulations, in that President Obama was not allowed to appoint somebody to the court because of politics, not because of the way the Constitution works. So I worry. I think all of us should take a step back. I think we should do our best to come together as much as we can on the rule of law, on things like what is the evidence for a medication being safe or not safe. Let's agree to what it is. And let's agree that if we've allowed the FDA to be that agency of professionalism, that we should allow that to stand and not make it political.
Susan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rob.
That's Susan Liebel, political scientist at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, with us for a look at a pair of rulings by federal judges in separate cases related to the abortion medication mifepristone. There's some big audio news today. The Library of Congress announced the new inductees into the National Recording Registry. As usual, there's a lot of variety. The program highlights, quote, the richness of the nation's audio legacy and underscores the importance of assuring the long-term preservation of that legacy for future generations. Some highlights of this year's class, the oldest known recording of mariachi music from 1908 and 1909, a political analysis of the situation in Europe at the outbreak of World War II in 1939 by American correspondent Dorothy Thompson, the Super Mario theme song, and lots more music, jazz, pop, classical, and beyond, with artists including Queen Latifah and John Lennon, John Denver and Fletcher Henderson, There's a Stairway to Heaven and a Flash Dance, and the 1980s song that told us what sweet dreams are made of. Find out more today at 6 on 1A+. Check out the full list of the Library of Congress website. While you're there, nominate this announcement that I'm making right now for next year's list. You never know. This is Central Time. Everybody's looking for something. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we learn what strep throat looks like this year amid a shortage of one form of an antibiotic often given to children with the infection. Now, people around Wisconsin and neighboring states will head out to their local wetlands this Saturday, hoping to hear this sound. That's the call of the whooping crane, one of the birds that volunteers will be watching for during this year's annual Midwest Crane Count. The International Crane Foundation has held the count on a large scale since the 1980s, now covers more than 150 counties in 7 states. Sarah Gavney Moore is the Digital Communications Program Manager for the International Crane Foundation, which is based in Baraboo. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us and letting us share our story with you this afternoon.
Yeah, what is the goal of our Midwest Crane Count?
Well, it's kind of twofold. One, the main goal since it started in 1976 is to, it's a really powerful tool for creating awareness about cranes and their wetland habitats. But what also it does help us do is really help us study the population trends and the new areas where cranes are colonizing. When it was first started in the mid-70s, cranes were just coming back to Wisconsin, so it really allowed us to watch them as the population grew and dispersed. And now we're doing that in states like Ohio, where cranes have been recolonizing the last few years.
There are a lot of volunteers around the Midwest who take part each year. How do things on a practical level work? What do they do?
Well, to get involved, if we have someone who's a new counter, you can go to the International Crane Foundation's website at cranecount.org, and that will put you right on the Crane Count landing page. The first step is to look to see if you have a county coordinator. And we have county coordinators distributed throughout the seven states that are involved in the count. And they help with locally publicizing the count, as well as helping counters choose a survey site, making sure they have their data sheet, helping answer questions. If you go to our website and you find that there isn't a county coordinator for your area, you can contact the International Crane Foundation and we can help you get involved. And you can do that by emailing us at cranecount@savingcranes.org.
We've got a caller. Christian is with us in Madison. Christian, hello. Christian, are you there?
Oh, hi, I'm from Madison, and what's it called? I hear cranes all the time, and I think the crane calls are pretty, like, the calls of the cranes are pretty majestic and beautiful, and they just put me in a certain place that makes me wonder, how did just some biomatter turn into these beautiful, majestic things?
Christian, you know? Thanks for the call. Can I ask how old you are?
I am 11.
All right. Thanks for calling in, Christian. Now, an 11-year-old a few decades ago, Sarah, wouldn't necessarily hear that sound so much here in Wisconsin. Could you talk a little bit about why we have so many more sandhills now in particular that Christian's able to hear?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you so much for that call and your enthusiasm. I think we have a future craniac. Well, sandhill cranes almost disappeared from Wisconsin in the first quarter of the century. There were concerns that maybe there were only a couple dozen breeding pairs here. And the reason for that is there was unregulated hunting and also our wetlands. If you're hearing cranes, you're probably near a wetland area or an area where they can find food and where they can find a safe place to nest and find safety from predators. But what happened is that there were laws enacted that protected the cranes from hunting, and then also laws that help us protect our wetlands. And then also I think just people like our caller who are excited about cranes. I think more and more people are opening their eyes to the cranes that are in their neighborhoods and seeing what they represent. There is almost a spiritual component to them, isn't there?
Thanks for that call, Christian. And Christian also wondered some about, you know, the life cycle, the biology of cranes. How much of a crane's development happens, say, in wetlands here in Wisconsin?
Sure, yeah. So the cranes are beginning to pair right now, and the male and female pair will mate and lay 1 to 2 eggs, and those chicks will hatch out after about a month. And then the family, they'll raise them for about 3 months near the nest. And then at about 3 months of age, the chick will begin developing its flight feathers and begin flying. And that's all in preparation for migrating south in the fall.
Now, we've been talking about sandhill cranes. Now, let's talk about the whooping crane effort. This has been a long-term project still going on. How are the whooping cranes doing in Wisconsin now, Sarah?
Yeah, they're doing well. There are kind of varies on year to year, but the most recent years there have been between 70 and 75 whooping cranes in the state, and that's a huge difference. With sandhill cranes, we estimate there are probably around 50,000 that are found here in Wisconsin. But those 70-ish whooping cranes are coming up. They're breeding, they're pairing, they're breeding, they're raising chicks, and we actually have a really cool feature on our website. It's Whooper Matt. www.savingcranes.org. You can go on that map and you can see where the different cranes are by county. And we do keep the whooping cranes location. They're not secret, but we keep them at the county level to make sure those birds have safe places to nest and to raise their families.
And as we wrap up, Sarah, you mentioned people can go online and register. You're still looking for last-minute people to sign up for Saturday's Crane Count?
We are, yeah. There's still time to get involved. Just go to cranecount.org, look for your county coordinator, and if not, email us at cranecount@savingcranes.org.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That's Sarah Gavney Moore, Digital Communications Program Manager at the International Crane Foundation, which is based in Baraboo. She talked with us ahead of this Saturday's annual Midwest Crane Count. We've got a link to more info at wpr.org/centraltime. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about a comedian's search for humor in tragedy.
A house fire is a tragic thing to live through, and comedian J.C. Catlin would agree. He's done it. But in his new short film, he also proves that tragedy plus time equals comedy.
My name is J.C. Catlin. I wrote and am the star of everything I learned when my house burned down, and I am a comedian.
It only takes a few hours for your house to burn down. But after that, you continue to live inside its burnt-out husk for months and years. When my house in rural Wisconsin burned down, it was the coldest day of the year.
JC had fired up the seldom-used wood stove in the basement to help keep his family warm.
And then all of a sudden I thought, you know, that's smelling kind of strong. And so I got up and all of a sudden heard my kids screaming. And by the time I got into the living room, there was already like flames shooting up through the floor.
He managed to put the fire out briefly with one of his fire extinguishers, but as he went to grab another, the fire reignited and quickly grew.
So I just kind of like called 911 and ran away, you know, thinking the propane tank is going to explode or something. Like you want to get away from the house because it was already just totally engulfed in flames.
Everyone made it out safely and managed to stay warm, even the hamster.
When you're grabbing the cup, walking out with the hamster cage, putting it in the back of the car, you know it's bad.
A couple days later, he went back and posted a video to YouTube of the aftermath.
It somehow has turned into a cave. Typically, houses, when they burn down, don't turn into a cave. But in this case, my house decided that it would. So I thought that while it's still cold, and the caveness is preserved, that we really have to document this because it is important to remember in these times of loss that something new and beautiful always is left in the ashes. And in this case, it's stalactites and stalagmites, my two favorite kind of stalag things.
So the water from the firefighters' hoses was freezing to the ceiling from the cold, melting from the fire, and then refreezing on tables, counters, and floors.
Which was, you know, kind of oddly beautiful, but also, you know, when it's your own house, it's just kind of like, it's pretty heavy imagery.
Considering how tragic the fire was, the YouTube video was actually kind of funny in places. JC says he wasn't really going for humor, but it got him thinking. And that's where his friend Joe comes in.
My name is Joe Pickett. I'm the director of Everything I Learned When My House Burned Down, and also the curator of the Found Footage Festival.
Jokes are how JC and Joe both make a living. So finding some humor in the fire came naturally to them.
Takes the edge off, you know, and sometimes it's necessary to get through these things any way you can.
I think laughing at tragedy is a uniquely Wisconsin thing. And for this film, we're really trying to strike the balance between like, yeah, this is a tragic thing and we shouldn't just be laughing at it. But then it's also like, this is how we deal with it.
So they filmed JC inside the burned house like he was still living there.
That's the conceit of the short, is that we wanted JC to go about his normal day-to-day routine in the burnt-out house. So yeah, he's vacuuming, he's listening to extremely warped records that don't play on a record player anymore.
Hi, is this the library? Yeah, what's your policy on, like, if the books are, you know, a little bit, like, on fire?
JC says in the film that things get better, but sometimes it's hard to notice. 2 years later, He's still dealing with it.
Going through and, you know, remembering, oh, we don't have a grapefruit spoon. We got to buy a grapefruit spoon. That's every single day. You know, there's just something that you don't have that you used to have, and then you assume it's somewhere because you used to have one. Oh, no, it burned in the fire. You know, so that still goes on all the time.
For more on Everything I Learned When My House Burned Down, a comedy, you can visit our website at wisconsinlife.org. Thanks, guys.
Sweet.
Great.
Thanks.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Coming up, strep throat is back. An infectious disease expert explains what to look out for and when to go and get tested for it. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, strep throat has crept back up along with other infections with the end of most pandemic precautions. Strep is more common in kids. Adults can get it too, though, and strep A, a more dangerous potentially form of the infection, is higher this year in both kids and adults. Megan Meller is an infection preventionist at Gunderson Health System. Megan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What are we looking at when it comes to numbers that we know of strep throat infections these days?
Yeah, so what we're seeing here locally, at least throughout the Gunderson system, is we call it a positivity rate. So the number of people getting tested and the number of those who are getting positive. And we're seeing that rate sitting between 40 and 50%. So quite a number of people who are getting tested for it are in fact testing positive.
Now, a lot of respiratory illnesses kind of waned, it seemed like, during COVID. People were wearing masks, not associating as much. How does this compare to COVID era, and how does that compare to pre-COVID?
So strep throat, or the bacteria that causes it, it's really behaving very similarly to what we were seeing with these respiratory viruses during the pandemic. And so, you know, prior to the pandemic, strep throat was just something that kids, you know, school-age kids just learned to deal with. But during the pandemic, cases really dropped off, you know, along with what we were seeing with like flu and RSV. And then similarly, now that we're coming out of the pandemic, you know, schools are reopened, restrictions have ended, we're seeing this surge in cases, much like we were seeing with RSV earlier this year.
Now, I'm learning as this goes on, there are different kinds of strep. What kinds are we seeing most commonly, and how do they differ from one another in terms of how severe they are?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a couple different types of bacteria out there, but the one that causes strep throat is what we call group A strep. And this is where, you know, it can cause concern because, you know, for most cases of strep throat, overwhelmingly, you know, kids recover really fast. But what's alarming is that sometimes those infections can become invasive. And so what that means is the whole body gets infected and people get really sick. You know, prior to this, you know, we've seen adults come down with group A strep invasively for other reasons. But what we're starting to see now is those numbers in both kids and adults increase.
What is the most common treatment for strep throat?
Antibiotics. And so, you know, it's very common antibiotics, amoxicillin, even penicillin, can treat those strep throat infections. And, you know, for the most part, it's pretty effective. Bacterial resistance is pretty rare, but it can happen. And, you know, we have seen that sporadically here. And so it's always a good educational for the community to say, if you're not getting better with your current antibiotics, to talk to your healthcare provider again, because you might need it to have your treatment changed up.
Talking to Megan Meller, infection preventionist at Gunderson Health System, looking at the return of strep throat into common circulation. If you have a question, you can call in quick at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Megan, my kids are a little older now, but when they were younger, I think my most common health question as a parent was, when do I take my kids in to get tested for strep? How do you answer that question?
Yeah. And I think, you know, this is a question a lot of parents ask because, you know, a sore throat's a sore throat. So it's like, is it a virus? Is it bacteria? A really good distinction with strep throat is you won't have the upper respiratory condition. So you won't have the coughing, the sneezing, the nasal congestion. You're just going to have that sore throat, usually some swollen tonsils and a fever. So that's really a good hallmark that if they're having those symptoms in the absence of upper, you know, the congestion, to make sure that they get in and get those antibiotics.
Do doctors tend to prescribe those antibiotics without getting that strep test first? Because a lot of the things that cause those other symptoms are viruses. Antibiotics don't do anything to them.
Right, you know, and some may, but there's a really common, easy test that can be done in most clinics that can happen, you know, where parents can have the results of that test before they even leave the clinic. And so it's really helpful for providers to know that right away, this is what we're dealing with. And it kind of looks at it. It's very slick.
I want to talk about the complications of untreated strep. Now, when I was a kid, I had strep throat all the time. One time we were looking through our files and it turned into scarlet fever for me, which I didn't know was a thing still. What are some of the things that can happen if we have strep and don't treat it?
Yeah, and this is when it can get really serious. Look at it. It's still overwhelmingly rare, but sometimes it can potentially lead to death, you know, without treatment. And so that's where if someone's not showing any indication that they're improving, they might maybe say they had strep throat, but now they're developing a full-blown rash in their body. You know, the fever is really high. It's really important that they are seen in like the ER urgent care, because that's when you might need some more intensive antibiotics to really cure that infection.
Now, if we know someone in a family has strep, how quickly does it spread from one person to another? Can we take steps to avoid catching it from one another, say in a household?
Yeah, because, you know, when we talk about like who's at risk, you know, we know kids are very commonly can get it, but also adults who interact with kids are also fairly susceptible. And we're seeing kind of that with grandparents too. And that's because strep A can spread by respiratory droplets or even like direct contact. So if you're sharing, you know, drinking out of the same cup, or just even if a, you know, child, you know, wipe their hands on a surface and then you touch that surface with a hand and then touch your face, that's a really easy way to get exposed. And so prevention is then also pretty easy. It's not sharing utensils if someone is sick. It's washing your hands, not touching your face with dirty hands, and just regularly disinfecting the household.
Now, I know flu, there's a flu season, influenza, fall, well, half the year, it seems like some years, but is strep seasonal like that, or does it come and go a little more predictably?
Yeah, you know, there is some seasonality to it. So commonly the seasons last from December to April. So it's still pretty long. So hopefully we start to see a decrease in numbers shortly. This past year, so in late 22, we did start seeing an uptick in September. So it did kind of start a little earlier, but that's, again, not surprising given how strange some of these other viruses have been behaving out of their season. So hopefully we'll start to see that resume or kind of come back to normal next year.
Now, as you mentioned, kids vulnerable to this, something to take seriously. And anybody, are there people we're particularly worried about when it comes to stress with strep, when it comes to things like compromised immune systems?
Thankfully, not really. So, you know, in some of these cases too, you know, even kids who are getting, you know, or, you know, getting these invasive infections, to my knowledge, you know, there's no other underlying health condition. Sometimes, you know, these infections just kind of behave on their own accord. And so that's why, you know, if your child is in a little bit more immune compromised, it's always important to take those extra precautions just to make sure they're not getting unnecessarily exposed. But for the common person, you know, just taking those additional steps of just, you know, if you're not feeling well, stay home, you know, stay home. Be mindful of who you're sharing utensils with when you're not feeling well, and washing your hands.
Now, within a clinical setting, are there extra steps you need to take during strep season to make sure things don't spread within a clinic? It's from what you described as transmission, it sounds like the sort of things I assume you're doing anyway.
Exactly. You know, and I think from an, you know, infection prevention standpoint, these are things that we always relayer with staff as, you know, making sure that you're washing your hands before you go into an appointment, before you leave an appointment. And then our standard room disinfection practices apply. So it's something that we're not concerned about spreading within our clinics because it's such an easy bacteria to kill with standard disinfectants.
Now, I'm allergic to something most of the year. So I have a constant game called allergy or current illness. What are some of the things that would distinguish, you know, that seasonal allergy that, say, 70 degree weather in April in Wisconsin might bring about versus a strep symptom?
Oh, I totally get that. You know, and I think because I have the same thing, it's like, is this a cold or is this allergies? And I think one of the things we just need to remember with strep throat is that you're not going to have those respiratory symptoms. And so I think the bigger question is it a cold or is it allergies versus strep throat? You know, another hallmark too of strep throat is if you have your child open up their mouth and look at their tonsils, if they have any white streaking on their tonsils, and I think if we've all had it before, you know, you're like, you know what to see. That's also a good indication that you might have strep throat or at least some sort of bacterial infection and need to be seen.
We've been talking about strep, but are there any other illnesses on the horizon that you as an infection preventionist in Wisconsin have on your radar right now?
You know, not at the moment, thankfully. You know, we're always kind of watching current rates of, you know, Lyme, you know, tick season is not far around the corner here, especially here in Wisconsin with the warmer weather. So, you know, we're always watching those numbers and always just kind of staying alert because, you know, in this day and age, you never know what's right around the corner.
Megan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me again.
That's Megan Meller, infection preventionist at Gunderson Health System. She talked to us about strep throat. She mentioned ticks. I already have a friend who already had a tick out in nature this season. So keep an eye out when you're out hiking. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the modern United States is built around cars and roads and parking lots, and a guest makes the case that that's often not a good thing. Meet the author of the new book, Carmageddon, How Cars Make Life Worse and What to Do About It. Plus, we'll look at the role of siblings in our lives and what having them or not having them can mean for childhood development. Join those conversations and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then you can learn how to learn and use those lessons to do better at school and on the job. Find out more from the psychologist who wrote the book Study Like a Champ. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.